last summer, there were tons of Trump bumper stickers around here, and they all seem to be gone now.
Well, boldly extrapolating from that, Trump's finished.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, and we have Ezra Klein and Sarah Cliff with us, the usual cast of characters.
Yeah, but not in the usual places. Yeah.
Where are you, Matt?
I am in Bangor, Maine, Trump country, sort of, but also Susan Collins country, visiting my dad and, working and podcasting remotely. Things are lovely here. The ladies at the Blue Hill Historical Society are very excited about moderate Republicans.
What happened with moderate Republicans this week?
Susan Collins, she's doing things.
Okay, so we got a good episode. We're going to get to Jeff Sessions and his very odd position in the administration.
And with Trump's management in general.
His odd manager, who he has been stuck with as a boss. We are going to talk about retail clinics and emergency healthcare in a very exciting white paper. But we are going to start where all the news is, which is once again healthcare, where the Republican Senate healthcare effort has, it came back from Detroit and it came out of the grave and reared its head. And we are, I just want to start by kind of summarizing where we are, and then we can talk through a little bit about what might happen next. So it became clear, over this weekend going into Monday, that Republicans were starting to cobble together the votes to open debate on a healthcare repeal bill. One of the things that was very confusing in this process is they were not making clear which healthcare bill they were opening debate on. At this point, I count at least three completely separate approaches to repeal that are being considered. And within that, a lot of them have 2.0, 3.0, versions that have amendments.
Can you just quickly define what opening debate means in this context?
Yeah. So opening debate means that you will start having this 20-hour debate on, different sort of healthcare issues. Technically, they are opening debate on the House-passed bill, the American Healthcare Act, but they are not planning to vote on that. They quickly substitute in other bills as an amendment. So where we are right now, and this is 10 o'clock or so on Wednesday morning, it will near certainly actually be different by the time you listen to this podcast, is debate was opened on Tuesday afternoon in a very dramatic fashion where Senator McCain flew back from Arizona coming out of brain cancer treatment to cast the final vote they need to open debate. Debate opens Tuesday afternoon around 2:30. They move on to reading both the bills, which is a very long, arduous process for some poor Senate clerk. And then last night around 9 p.m., they held a vote on the Better Care Reconciliation Act. It was technically a procedural vote by everyone voting. They understood it as a vote on, should we continue forward on this bill is mainly the Senate's repeal and replace bill. This one has the new tax credits, the repeal of Medicaid expansion. That bill went down by 9 votes. This morning, they've opened up debate again. We are expecting at 11:30 a.m., which is in the future when we are recording this, but will be in the past when you listen to this.
Whoa.
We are expecting a vote on the Obamacare Repeal and Reconciliation Act. This is a bill that just repeals Obamacare, does not do replacement, that is also expected to fail. And then we get to, we're expecting to be a flood of amendments and things get really weird and unpredictable. We don't really know what's going to happen. We're told, and again, this is in our future, in your past, there will be a vote around 3:30 today on sending this process back to committee offered by Democrats, meant to embarrass Republicans about skipping the whole committee process here. The ultimate goal seems to be to move towards a final vote on what has now been called skinny repeal, which is really the most bare bones version of scaling back the Affordable Care Act that would get rid of the individual mandate, get rid of the medical device taxes, because they apparently have the most wonderful lobbyists at the medical device industry who have kept this issue alive, get rid of the employer mandate, and that would be essentially what the Senate moves forward. If that happens, if McConnell is able to get those 50 votes for skinny repeal, which seems like the only thing that has a chance of moving forward, you then go to conference committee. And there's this ethos developing that, I think reminds a lot of us of what happened in the House, where a lot of senators are saying, we can't agree on something. This is really hard. but let's just send Skinny Repeal to conference and we'll work it out there. Like, we'll make it better there. And this is something that feels so familiar. There's been this constant attitude of, well, we'll fix it at this next step. And like, we'll fix it there. And we know there's problems, but you have to take this vote because we have to keep moving forward. We have to keep the debate open and, you know, don't worry about this vote. It's not the final product. But we're running out of moments to fix it. Conference committee is the last step before sending it back to the chambers and then sending it to the president.
What is conference committee?
Conference committee is where the House and the Senate bring their versions of a bill and they kind of hash out the differences and send something back to the two chambers to vote on. It's unclear how exactly this would work out in this case because let's say we do have Skinny Repeal pass. Basically, the House shows up with the American Healthcare Act, which is this really complex, like changing the tax credit subsidies, turning Medicare into a per capita cap, or Medicaid into a per capita cap program. And the Senate shows up with their two-page bill that says repeal the individual mandate. And we don't know how that shakes out. I've heard both the theory from Republican Hill staffers that they might just send Skinny Repeal straight to the House and say, like, this is what we got. Like, this is what we're working with. Let's take this incremental step and, like, count it as a win. If they try and conference it, you'll probably have something like the American Healthcare Act go to the Senate. We don't know if it can pass. Again, there'll be this argument, like, we have to do something. We have to get a win. But conference committee is where they'll decide what the final product that both houses need to approve looks like. And if something makes it through conference and through the House and Senate, President Trump has said, like, he will sign anything. He is there with his pen. He is, like, ready to sign something that has the words Obamacare repeal in it. And, you know, as we move further in this process, like I was saying earlier, there are just less points to do what Republicans have said again and again is, like, fix it at a later step. We are running out of the later steps at this point.
Also, it's worth saying that, you know, conference committee as an institution has sort of withered over the years, right? But the classic idea was that you would have somewhat different versions of bills passed by the House and passed by the Senate, probably with some level of bipartisan support in both chambers. And then you would appoint a committee of, you know, members from both sides of the aisle, from both chambers, and they would work in a deliberative way. It's very unlikely that we're going to see a conference committee process in that sense, if only because we've dispensed with all the other aspects of regular order in Congress. So in practice, this means we're going to punt once again and give leadership another opportunity to work something out behind closed doors, try to present it to their members as a fait accompli. And it seems like even the narrative changed among Republicans that 36 hours ago, when the Skinny Repeal concept was first floated, the idea was really, okay, we'll punt it forward to conference committee and work something out there. But now as of this morning, they're talking more about, well, maybe if Skinny Repeal is what passes the Senate, they'll actually get the House to just go do that. And that will be what they call repealing and replacing Obamacare, is blowing up the individual market, maybe cutting some taxes and leaving Medicaid expansion in place.
I think there are a couple things to say about this. One just on quickly on a narrow conference committee point. The theory here, if it went through a conference committee, is a little bit like what happened with Medicare Part D. And you guys can correct me if I'm getting my history wrong here, but Medicare Part D, the bill that became Medicare Part D, was pretty bipartisan in the Senate. The original version passes. So in this way, it's different, but it's a more moderate version in the Senate. The original version passes with Ted Kennedy's support, actually, at that time. Then it goes to conference committee, and they end up with something much, much, much more conservative to pass the House. And so it comes back to the Senate, and all these Democrats feel super betrayed. Now, obviously, there are no Democrats on this bill, but what McConnell is doing is passing a very minimalistic version of Obamacare reform, as I think the right way to talk about it, out of the Senate, right? He's basically saying, hey, vote for this. Almost nothing is happening here except we are repealing the least popular part of Obamacare, totally heedless of the consequences for insurance markets. And then what would happen is that what would come back is a yes or no, up or down, you know, do you make good on your promise to repeal Obamacare or not vote for all these Senate, you know, quote unquote moderates, these more mainstream Senate Republicans, that is not going to be Skinny Repeal, right? That's going to be something much more conservative. And so your Rob Portmans, your Dean Hellers, they're, you know, they will have advanced this only to give themselves a much harder choice down the road. So I think that's one thing worth saying here, that we've seen this play run before, where conference committee, something passes out of the Senate that's more moderate, conference committee comes back with something much more conservative, and then, you know, Republican leadership jams, tries to jam their moderate members, and, you know, and it has worked for them before. The other thing, and it just goes to the essential insanity of this entire process. Like, just like take a step back on skinny repeal. When we did that piece a couple weeks ago, where we went and asked Republican senators, what are you trying to achieve in this whole process? And we just got these gobbledygook answers. One of the answers we got a lot, Chuck Grassley was one of the people who said this, is like, Obamacare's individual markets are exploding. They're imploding. They're devastated. They don't work. We need to stabilize the individual markets. Now, there are ways you might do that. Lamar Alexander, the Republican chair of the HELP committee, has a hearing on the books for sometime in the future on how to stabilize individual markets. But what everybody agrees on is that just taking the individual mandate out without any kind of replacement is going to destabilize individual markets further. And so if Republicans did do the other version of this, right, they just pass skinny repeal, they jam the House on it somehow, and they send it to Donald Trump and they declare a win, there's going to be this moment that comes, like, not long, a year from now, depending on how the bill is structured, where premiums just skyrocket.
Oh, I think not even, yeah, I think it'd be this. So open enrollment starts on November 15th this year. And I think if you pass a bill, I believe the mandate repeal starts immediately. But let's say even if you decide to delay it a year because you're worried about market stability, what insurance company like wants to stay in that market where their customers are being told the individual mandate's being repealed, you don't have to buy insurance, they've just gotten their arms around like who is signing up for healthcare, and now they have to go into this market where people are told you don't actually have to buy healthcare, even if, you know, that's technically on the books. And even if skinny repeal doesn't pass, you know, we're in really the crunch time for insurance companies decide whether they want to sell Obamacare or not. I was talking to the Tennessee insurance regulator, who is the president of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and she was outlining to me in about mid-August or so, she and all these other insurance regulators are going to have to send a contract to their insurance plans who sell on healthcare.gov and say, okay, here's the rates we've approved. Send this back signed in mid-September if you want to sell coverage. And she is really worried that looking at what's going on, she has two insurance plans on the Tennessee marketplace. They're going to say, like, I'm not signing that contract. Like, I don't want to sell Obamacare. I think the effects would be very, very quick, like January quick. Just to put some numbers to it, CBO has analyzed a bill very similar to this, and they did it back in 2015. They estimate that 15 million people would lose coverage if you had something like skinny repeal go into a place, and premiums in the individual market would, in that analysis, it was by 2020, would rise 20%. It might be a few years out because we're moving a few years out.
So the one thing I want to, the big picture I want to put on this is that I've never really seen anything like this in politics. Like, this is not policymaking, it's anti-policymaking. I have never watched a process where what the legislators are doing, by their own, at this point, explanation, is taking a problem that they identified to solve and passing something they all agree will make it worse, right? No Republican is out there making the case that skinny repeal will stabilize a market anywhere. Now, that's why maybe this is really just a procedural move to get the conference committee, blah, 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 blah. But even so, usually the things you pass have a fig leaf of like, I am going to make the problem I have set out to solve better. And I know there's this argument that the only problem they're trying to solve is what can get 51 votes and, you know, something that we can say is Obamacare repeal and replace. But this is insane. I am flabbergasted that they would pass something. Like, look, like, Republicans don't like the individual mandate. That's fine. They came up with it. They turned on it. It's where we are. Like, we all get that. Replace it with something. I mean, early on in this process, Sarah, you were writing these great pieces looking at, you know, they're thinking about auto enrollment and continuous coverage. And there are ways you might re-architect this.
But they're a little stuck and a little, this is something else that's important that's happened since our last episode, is that the parliamentarian who kind of sets the rules for what can be debated in reconciliation, which is supposed to be limited to budgetary legislation, came out with a list late Friday evening around 6 p.m. saying, here's all this stuff that you can't do in reconciliation. And one of the things that was ruled out was this continuous coverage requirement. So they are trying to undo a bill that passed with 60 votes with only 50 votes, and it is very, very hard to undo all of it. So they are in a place with the Better Care Reconciliation Act, their kind of build, repeal, and replace Obamacare, where it's actually very hard to replace the individual mandate and convince the parliamentarian that it is a matter of budget. So they're a little stuck, and I don't think this is like an excuse. They decided to use reconciliation. This is the process they are using, and these are the consequences of it. But they are a little hamstrung in, like, moving forward those proposals at this point.
Right, but that's just what I mean, that, like, it's a normal thing in politics that you don't have enough votes to pass a bill you want to pass. Then you don't get to pass it. Like, it happens all the time. Like, it's not like, well, I don't have the votes to pass a bill I want to pass to solve the problem I want to solve. But plan B is I do have the votes to pass a bill I don't want to pass that will make the problem I want to solve worse. So, like, let's go with that. It's just weird.
Also, I mean, the 60 votes, I think, is a little bit of almost a red herring here, right? Because if you were able to slow this process down, which they could, right? Mitch McConnell does not need to be moving at this pace. And if he wanted to have Lamar Alexander walk across the hall and speak to, I forget who's ranking. Patty Murray, and say, Patty, you know, we've got a problem here, right? The president, the base, everybody expects us to do something that repeals and replaces Obamacare. What we would like to make that mean is that we take this individual mandate that has become a symbol of what is hateful about this. We would like to take it out, and we would like to replace it with a different mechanism that will help us stabilize the markets. Can Democrats work with us on doing that, and maybe also taking out this medical device tax that several Democrats also want to repeal? And in exchange, we're like not going to impose drastic cuts on Medicaid. I think, I don't know what Democrats would say to that, but I think Democrats would be crazy to not, you know, help Republicans bail themselves out, right? If what they really want is just a kind of a fig leaf repeal that gets rid of the individual mandate and comes up with some other mechanism to stabilize the marketplaces, they could and should do that as a bipartisan 60 vote bill, but they're making it, I mean, they are literally saying different things to different people as to whether the purpose of this legislation is to become law because they think it will be better than the status quo, or whether the purpose of this legislation is to serve as a Trojan horse for passing a much more comprehensive total rollback of health insurance for low-income families. And this has been, like, McConnell for weeks now has been doing one version or another of this, where he's telling moderates, oh, don't worry, these Medicaid cuts won't be implemented. And you have Republican senators. John McCain won these incredible plaudits on cable television for this speech he gave, where he came back and he was like, guys, like, this isn't how we should be doing things. But then after having said we shouldn't do things this way, he voted to open debate. He even voted for the BCRA bill, which he had previously denounced. And everyone is operating on so many different levels of bad faith that it's impossible to give any credit to anything that they're doing. If they wanted to state some objectives and work on them, I think a lot of these procedural impediments would get out of their way. But they're trying to pull a fast one. And I don't think they're even being clear to their own caucus as to what the full nature of the fast one they're trying to pull really is.
Well, I don't think they know. Maybe they do. And maybe, like, there's some, like, cunning behind the scenes game. It's unclear to me that leadership, like, knows which fast one they are attempting to pull, aside from the one that is able to get 51 votes and move out of the Senate, which, as you know, you mentioned, is a very bad way to do legislation and leads to these weird outcomes of pushing a bill that no one agrees is going to fix the problems with the Affordable Care Act. I do think in a way it actually plays quite well into Trump's strategy all along, which is he has really been one to highlight the failing marketplaces whenever an insurance company quits, whenever premiums go up. You know, he will say, like, you know, Obamacare's failing, Obamacare's falling apart. It isn't really. It certainly has its weak spots. There are some marketplaces that have some empty counties. But a lot of that is actually a reflection of all the uncertainty in the marketplace, the Trump administration not being clear about, you know, whether it's going to pay these cost sharing reduction subsidies, that a lot of this is being self-inflicted. But if you are trying to make the case, we have to pass a bill because Obamacare is failing, it certainly helps your case to make Obamacare fail a little more. One other thing I want to mention that surprised me about this week is the resilience of Medicaid. If you had told me, you know, when we went into this process that the final play in the Senate would be demolishing the individual market, but just like leaving Medicaid expansion totally intact, I probably would not have believed that, because Medicaid has often been a program that's been quite susceptible to budget cuts. It has a low-income population as its, you know, enrollee base. It doesn't have the strong lobby of Medicare, but Medicaid has proved really surprisingly resilient in this process. You know, I don't think all the way yet. Like, obviously, there is a House-passed bill that cuts Medicaid by about $800 billion, so not out of the woods. But I think it is notable and interesting that because of a handful of moderate senators who have been on the fence a little bit, Medicaid had to be taken off the table for the Senate when they get to, like, the last thing they think might be able to get enough support.
So one thing that I do think is interesting there, and again, I want to be cautious, because I would not at all be surprised to see the conference bill go back to full-bore Medicaid cuts. But as you say, like, at the moment we're at right now, what they're trying to pass out of the Senate, they've just taken Medicaid out. And by the way, to Matt's earlier point, Chuck Schumer has said that if they just want to have a conversation about stabilizing individual markets and not have a conversation about cutting Medicaid, Democrats would be happy to have that conversation. So it's not even like a hypothetical. They could just start talking to Democrats. And the fact that they're not implies to me that this skinny repeal bill is not a real thing. Like, this is not where they're going. This is a way to get to conference. But putting that aside for a minute, one thing I think we're seeing a lot of with Republicans right now is they're being very tactical without being at all strategic. They do not have a vision in their head of what a working healthcare market would look like. They don't have a vision in their head of what conservative healthcare policy should look like. They do not like have an idea of what all of this is supposed to lead to 6 years down the line or 10 years down the line. Like, Sarah, you and I have done a lot of work on what the Obamacare architects believed Obamacare would create. And in many ways, they were wrong, right? You wrote this great piece maybe now 6 or 8 months ago about the way in which they had big dreams for the exchanges. And in fact, it's been Medicaid that has been in many ways the success story of Obamacare. But there was like a theory of if it all worked out, what would happen. Republicans don't have that theory. And without that theory, as they just try to get 51 votes for fucking something, they're actually discrediting the ideas that they really needed to build up. So if you look at most Republican healthcare policy thinking, like take Paul Ryan's premium support plans for Medicare. What that basically does is it takes Medicare and makes it into an Obamacare-like individual market exchange structure. And if you look at really like all the Republican plans, they're all based on exchanges working. They want to have private insurance plans competing on centralized marketplaces regulated by states, subsidized by some kind of tax credit scheme, and that's supposed to work. And so what Republicans really need in order to create not just like a bill that can pass right now, but a model that will withstand the eventual return of a Democratic majority that will want to and is moving more towards something like Medicare for All or Medicaid buy-in or one of these much more government-based plans that I think is where the left is trending, and for correct reasons. What Republicans actually need is a working model that they can defend. If what they do instead is they destabilize individual markets further, they discredit exchanges, they make everybody believe that you actually cannot make a government-regulated market based on private insurance work, they're not only going to have created the conditions for Democrats to come in and replace whatever they built, but they're going to have nothing to say, right? They're not going to be able to say, no, like, we've got this much better idea over here. They will have, like, gotten an opportunity to try their idea and, like, both the Democratic version of that idea they will have said failed, and then they will have done their version of that idea and it will have failed. And so there's like going to be no private insurance-based healthcare policy model left. Like, all they will have left is Medicaid, Medicare, and other variants thereof. I mean, I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about how I think this story could end in some version of single payer. Not quite, but Medicare buy-in, Medicaid buy-in, et cetera. And a couple of years after Republicans detonate everything and the next Democratic president just uses a Mitch McConnell process to like pass sprinkle care nationally, I don't think they are thinking about this clearly at all. Like, this is not how an ideological movement builds a structure for its future success. This is robbing your future to try to get out of a very short-term political jam.
Our sponsor today is 23andMe.com. 23andMe.com is a genetic service that provides you with DNA reports about where your DNA comes from around the world. So you can explore what percentage of your DNA comes from different places like Italy, Finland, East Asia, Africa, wherever. Now through August 3rd, you could win a genetic adventure as 23andMe.com will choose one person each day for 23 days to travel to countries based on their DNA. Will you be one of the 23 people to win and travel to a location based on your DNA? Order your DNA kit for a chance to win a trip to a explore your connection to the world and travel like never before. To enter, visit 23andme.com. That's 23andme.com. That's the number 2323andme.com. So no purchase is necessary. It's open to legal U.S. residents 18 or older. Ends August 3rd. Must complete the 23andMe service. Visit 23andme.com/rules for free entry.
I was in the mountains for a couple of days, which is very nice, not thinking about most of this stuff. And when I came back and sort of got back into civilization on Monday night, and I turned on my computer. And now every time you go away, if you actually end up out of cellular and internet service for a couple of days, turning on the news has a quality of looking at that GIF from the show Community, where Donald Glover like walks back into the room with pizza and like everything is on fire and everybody is running around and like it's just total fucking chaos. But so I turned on my computer. And I just saw that Donald Trump had spent the past couple of days just running down his own attorney general. He gave an interview to the New York Times where he said, you know, I think it's very unfair that Jeff Sessions took the job and then recused himself from the Russia investigation. Then after he got criticism for that, he doubled down in a series of tweets and he began talking about, it's such an amazing formulation. The guy is nothing if not good at getting something to stick in your mind. Our beleaguered AG, Jeff Sessions, in his tweets, our beleaguered AG. Jeff Sessions is only beleaguered because Donald Trump keeps talking about him like this. Then he just gave an interview, I think, to the Wall Street Journal,
yes,
where he like slammed Jeff Sessions some more. And Donald Trump's attack on Jeff Sessions is 100% that Jeff Sessions took this job, but then later turned out to be not able to protect Donald Trump from personal investigation. And that was really unfair to Donald Trump, that his attorney general should be much, much better at stopping investigation into him personally, which is another way, and Matt has written about this a little bit, in which you find Donald Trump really does not believe in the rule of law applying to him, like really has deeply illiberal instincts when it comes to this stuff. But and so I want to bracket that for a sec, because I also just want to talk about the idea of Donald Trump as manager here. Donald Trump just got a new comms director, Scaramucci. Is it Anthony Scaramucci?
Anthony Scaramucci.
Yeah. He's a hedge fund guy, right, Matt?
Yeah, well, so he runs what's called a fund of funds, right? So it's like if you can't have access to investing in a high-fee hedge fund that will lose you money because you're not quite rich enough for that, you can pay a fee to Anthony Scaramucci, who will then pool your money with the money of other suckers and invest it in high-fee vehicles so that you're paying like two rounds of high management fees for not that great investments. So that's the new communications director.
So this guy became comms director because he's sort of a player in like New York tabloid media and CNBC. He gives good quotes, but he's really not got comms experience. So he went on to try to defend this today. And said, you know, he thinks this is great. It's a real New York way of doing business that Donald Trump is doing. He's not stabbing anybody in the back. He's stabbing him in the front in public. Now, Donald Trump could fire his attorney general. He has power to do that. He could go and talk to his attorney general. He could go manage the situation quietly with his attorney general. And instead of doing any of that, he's gone on a public campaign to humiliate Jeff Sessions until Jeff Sessions, I guess, resigns or unrecuses himself from the Russia investigation or something. One thing this has done is send shockwaves to all the other cabinet officials and senior staffers working for Donald Trump who are giving both blind and on-the-record quotes about how they're terrified now that Donald Trump will not stand by them And then will instead like try to humiliate them publicly as soon as they become a liability of any sort to him. There's a lot of talk that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has just like reached a personal fed up point. He's apparently taking a little break. He's on a little break.
Just as you do when you're Secretary of State.
But one thing I think is interesting about Tillerson doing this is Tillerson, if you ask what he is, he's an executive, right? I mean, he's an Exxon career guy. He's an oil and gas guy, but he's also a very talented CEO. And so like he believes in ways of managing people. I think it's sometimes like missed how much managers are like people who really rise up in managerial ranks. Like eventually that's what they think about. It's how they see the world. And Donald Trump, he is absolutely betraying every principle and every idea of how you would manage an organization, how you would keep people loyal to you, how you'd keep people from writing things or leaking things that hurt you later on, how you would keep the rest of your staff feeling like they should be on your side as opposed to like protecting their backside in case you come after them in some other way. And I mean, it is the most chaotic, counterproductive, insane, and in some ways scary way to run a government that I could imagine, all of it coming from the guy who, and when you talk to Trump, they said this was like the guy who portrayed himself as a successful businessman and executive who would bring business leadership principles to government. This is just like, it's not how businesses are run. It is not how you do it.
Right. Like, could you imagine, Ezra, like the equivalent of this would be like you going on Twitter and being like, Sarah Cliff is like a very bad health policy reporter. Like she is not very good at her job.
Our beleaguered healthcare reporter.
No, and then the follow-up would be, man, Sarah Cliff really looks beleaguered these days. I don't know what's up with that. Like, that is the equivalent situation. And one of the things I think might be a little different about how Trump sees management versus others is that he seems to think of his cabinet professionals as like, his guy that like he brought in who, you know, should feel lucky to be there, like is Jeff Sessions is being done a favor by like Trump allowing him to serve as attorney general and not that Jeff Sessions is serving the United States as attorney general. Jeff Sessions is serving Donald Trump as attorney general. That being said, like, I still think it's like very, it'd be an odd management tactic to, you know, blast your guy in public. But I think it's a distinction between who you feel like your staff in the federal government is serving that might dictate how you treat those people.
You've also seen from the first weekend that Trump served in office, a profound frustration on the Trump administration's part with the idea of the career civil service, right? I mean, they keep referring to career staff as Obama holdovers, which is like a fundamental misunderstanding of what's going on. And some of what you're seeing, like today, while I was driving up, Trump did a couple tweets criticizing Sessions for not having fired Andrew McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI, who's now acting director, on the grounds, Trump misstates this, but the true fact of the matter is that McCabe's wife was a candidate for a Virginia state legislative seat, not this past year, but the year before that. And she was supported, as you would expect, a Democrat trying to win a Virginia state legislature seat by a PAC associated with Terry McAuliffe. So, you know, Republicans have been saying for years that this is an evidence of some kind of bias and overstating it. But the fact of the matter is we have some reason to believe that Andy McCabe may be a Democrat. At a minimum, his wife is a Democrat. And he's also a career FBI agent, you know, who's just risen to a senior level in the organization's ranks, just as the vast majority of senior FBI officials are Republicans, based on what we know. And that's just kind of like the way it is, right? And presidents of both parties have dealt with this fact for eons. But Trump is, one thing he's doing by being so weird about this is he's destabilizing people's expectations, right? So you now have to understand, if you work in a U.S. attorney's office somewhere, if you work in the enforcement arm of the SEC, if you work for any of the other federal regulatory agencies who might take a look at businesses that are owned or affiliated with Donald Trump or with some of his billionaire cabinet members or with his friends who pose with him for photos at the Mar-a-Lago Club. You might have thought in an ordinary time, look, you're a professional. You have a job to do. There's the rule of law in the United States. It doesn't matter if a company is owned by a buddy of the president's. If they break the rules, you're supposed to enforce the law and ding them for it. Trump is calling all of that into question by daily publicly flaunting contempt for the idea of the rule of law. And then we watch congressional Republicans, and it clearly makes them uncomfortable, but not like do something about it uncomfortable, right? The message is being heard. If you work in a regional office of the EPA and you're thinking, okay, will the institutions of the American government have my back if the president of the United States decides he wants to try to ruin my life because I enforced the law against one of his golf courses? The answer is no, right? If you are Jeff Sessions, right, if you are a iconic figure in conservative politics, they may kind of sort of have your back. If you are James Comey, right, a Bush appointee, rich, well-connected, media-savvy guy, they may kind of have your back. But if you're some nobody, if you're like actually a Democrat who, you know, doesn't support Republican causes, like you're done for, right? And that to me is what Trump is doing. I shouldn't say Trump. I mean, Trump is taking actions, but it's like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, every day they wake up and they say, nope, I'm not going to try to defend the legal order in the United States. That's all they do every day. Like, that's their legacy. They are working about as hard as they possibly could to, like, help Donald Trump just tear down the foundations of the American government.
And one thing I would just add to that is that it goes the other way, too, because you're not done for. I mean, this is a point that I think you're implying around the civil service. Donald Trump can't fire you. If you are that EPA person and you're enforcing something against a golf course, like, Donald Trump can't fire you. And so one thing that's happening here is Donald Trump is turning the entire federal bureaucracy hostile to him personally. Like, they see correctly that the president of the United States, it's not just that he's supposed to be their boss, but he's also their enemy, and he doesn't like them, and he doesn't trust them, and he doesn't want to preserve the things they've spent their lives building, and he will try to attack them. And that's actually a bad position. It's a bad position for them, as you say, Matt. It's also a bad position for him, because one, it's harder for him to do things through the bureaucracy, right? Because they drag their feet. So there are a lot of ways they can make life harder. Two, it's just, there's a lot of things that can get leaked. There's a lot of ways in which embarrassing comments and meetings and whatever. One of the interesting things is the DOJ has been one of the few places where Trump has really been getting things done, because Sessions is an unusual character in that he was both high level enough to run a cabinet agency, an important cabinet agency, but he was also like a real Trumpist guy, a very early endorser of Donald Trump, a very systematic and sustained supporter of Trump throughout the election. And so it's like, that's been one of the few places where Trump's agenda has really been coming through pretty clearly, in part because Sessions actually shares it. Now Trump is turning the DOJ in those ways against him, just as he turned the FBI against him, just as he's done this systematically in other places. I also want to back out to just say, I mean, we are looking, I think that we are very primed to think about the Saturday Night Massacre from the Nixon years as like this one thing, and look for it to happen in the same way again, where Nixon, you know, demands that the special prosecutor or independent prosecutor is fired, and then, you know, the AG says no, so Nixon fires the AG, and the deputy AG says no, so Nixon fires that guy, and, you know, it goes on down the line. I think that a way to imagine what we're watching play out here is a sort of slow motion Saturday Night Massacre, where he fired Comey as a way to try to stop the investigation. That didn't work. An independent prosecutor in Mueller got appointed. So now I think he's been told you can't just fire Jeff Sessions. I think that what makes all this make sense is somebody said to Donald Trump, it's not going to look good if you fire your attorney general because he cannot protect you from the Russia investigation. So now Trump is trying to turn up the heat and make Jeff Sessions resign. The word on the street right now is that Jeff Sessions is not going to resign, that Trump has got Sessions back up and like Sessions is like pissed off and is going to stay there and make Trump fire him. So maybe Trump fires him, maybe he doesn't. Maybe Trump demands that the Mueller, I mean, all this comes back to the Mueller investigation. What Trump wants is somebody to shut down the Mueller investigation. This is a kind of a Saturday night massacre that we're watching. And one question is whether it's successful, right? Whether or not Trump is actually able to drive Sessions from office, either by firing him directly or by just making it impossible for him to be around. He's obviously not going to appoint Rosenstein, the deputy AG, to run the organization. Rosenstein appointed Mueller. And Trump, in one of these same interviews where he's attacking Sessions, referred to Rosenstein as some guy from Baltimore, which, like, there was so much encoded in that, right? Just what Trump meant by just, like, dismissing him as, like, a Baltimore, like, city Democrat, you know, just like you could tell what was happening in Trump's head. But this is Trump trying to fire his way out of legal trouble. And in different ways, like there's been some obstruction for him, like the first thing he tried didn't quite work. And then, you know, I think that he feels pressure not to just fully like assault Sessions and just do it himself. But we are very close right now to the very much the same kind of thing that Nixon did. It's just happening in a slower and weirder way.
It also helps me to remember we're like 6 months into the Trump presidency right
now. That can't
be
right.
I checked and it has been 6 months since January. You know, Jeff Sessions, like you said, Ezra, was this like Trumpist guy, like with him through the whole campaign. Who is going to want to come into this administration? Like when you watch, and it's like you said, it's not just Sessions. At the Boy Scouts' Jamboree, which is a very odd place to talk about this, Trump made some offhand comment about Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, where he said, well, maybe I'll fire Tom Price if he can't get like Obamacare repeal done, even though Tom Price isn't in Congress and isn't really like in charge of that task. It's really like a pervasive part of like working in the Trump administration. It seems hard to get high quality members of your cabinet when they come in. Usually you come into a cabinet position thinking this is like a high profile job. It'll raise your profile. You will be able to do cool things that pay you a lot of money after you leave your cabinet position. So you take it. It's a harder sell to take a cabinet position where you might have the president, you know, tweeting about how terrible you are a few months into serving in that candidate position. And like maybe the payoff is you get to write some like salacious tell-all after you leave. But it certainly, I imagine, gives folks who might consider serving pause to think about what they might be signing up for. And there's a lot of months left in the Trump presidency. Like there are cabinet, you know, officials who are going to resign, maybe just because they're moving on. Like I feel like by the time we got to the end of the Obama first term, there'd been like a lot of turnover in the cabinet because that's just how things go. They're intense, high pressure jobs. Filling these jobs seems like it'll be more challenging when people have a sense like this is the manager I am signing up to work for.
And you got to wonder about, you know, some of these roles are being filled right now by people who, you know, had good things going, right? I mean, Rex Tillerson was CEO of ExxonMobil, right? You know, he took this job and Secretary of State, it's a big job, but it wasn't an obvious no-brainer for him. And I don't think anyone could say it's like worked out well for him in terms of his public reputation. Jim Mattis and John Kelly were retired generals. It's sort of a good life as a retired general. You can maybe do a little corporate board type work. You don't necessarily need to be treated with a total lack of dignity. We had today, Trump announced on Twitter a new policy barring transgender people from serving in the American military. Apparently, nobody at the Defense Department had any idea this was coming. You know, that's just kind of the way Trump does things. It's going to make people not want to do this stuff, and it's going to further erode the sort of capacity of the government to govern. But it's been clear, I think, for a while that Donald Trump doesn't really care about that. And at least for his first 6 months in office, that has been okay, right? I mean, nothing has like happened objectively where we are saying the erosion of the basic competency of the leadership in the American government has caused a huge high-profile public catastrophe. And maybe in some ways, like, the Trump voters were right and having people who know what they're doing doesn't actually matter and all the experts are wrong. My intuition is that like we will be tested as a country at some point by problems either in the world or in the economy. And we're going to come to deeply, deeply regret that we have C-list, you know, guys like running around and not a real administration of talented and competent professionals.
I think that's right. And another thing here that I just think is worth calling out, you guys have both mentioned, well, who would take these jobs? Well, somebody will take these jobs, right? Somebody will be attorney general. But what Trump has created, and this is a way that authoritarian leaders work, this is a way that very dysfunctional organizations work. Trump has made clear what kind of person should work and will work out in his administration, which is a personal loyalist. And so what that means is that the people who are going to be willing to take, let's say Trump did fire Jeff Sessions, right? The signal is if you are like a good attorney general candidate who just like wants to run a really good DOJ, you do not fucking want this job. Like you will be rendered toxic. You will be asked to make decisions that you should never make. In order to retain your job, you will humiliate yourself in public. But if you're like, I don't know, like Rudy Giuliani, who's one of the people who have been, you know, mentioned for this, and you just like are totally cool being a absolute Trump loyalist at this point in order to, you know, then go on Trump TV later. And I mean, there's a version of this that works out for people if they're willing to mortgage enough of their personal
integrity.
I don't
even know if that's true if you look at like Sean Spicer leaving, because he was willing to mortgage a lot. And he just had this like humiliating exit from the Trump administration this past week.
Yeah, but I agree. I totally agree. But so this goes to the second point of this, I was going to say, which is, so on the one hand, the only people now who make sense to come in are loyalists and like hacks, right? And it should make all of us very uncomfortable. The FBI, Thomas Wray, I think, the person Trump nominated to replace Comey as FBI director is reasonably credentialed. But as Matt has written, given what we know about what Trump wants from an FBI director, there's no reason we should trust anybody who has made it through the interview process with Trump, similar to all these other positions. So you're going to have an administration over time composed really of real hacks and loyalists, like really people you do not want running these organizations because they put their loyalties to Donald Trump, not to the rule of law, not to competent administration. But on the other hand, and this goes to your point about Spicer and others, as people leave, well, they have to somehow rescue their reputation. And what can they do to do that? Well, one of the classic ways you rescue your reputation after a bad run in government is you write a tell-all memoir embarrassing the people you just served with and showing that all along, like you were a voice for sanity and integrity on the inside. And like one of the great examples of this is Paul O'Neill in the first Bush administration, a Treasury secretary, like Rex Tillerson, came from business. So, you know, he was like a well-known business guy. And he just like was totally steamrolled by the political side of the organization and then wrote this like worked with Ron Suskind to write this absolutely vicious memoir called, I think it's called The Price of Loyalty, if I'm not misremembering. And I think you're going to have a lot of that in the Trump administration in order for people like Sean Spicer and much more to point like people like Rex Tillerson to recapture their sort of integrity and just their society standing after this. They're going to have to make clear they were one of the good guys. And the way they're going to do that is to show like how bad the administration was and, you know, how much they tried to make things better before they were driven out. Very, very, very bad incentive structure for the current White House, right? Because Trump and all of them will then be on the receiving end of all of these highly credible leaks, highly credible memoirs. In his business life, Trump has made everybody sign non-disclosure agreements. Apparently in his personal life, he's made a lot of people sign non-disclosure agreements. He had mused about doing that in government. I don't believe he can do that, or at least has not done that. And so you're going to get a stream of memoirs, tell-alls, big pieces, a lot of people leaking in an ongoing way so that when they leave, they have friendly reporters they can tell their side of the story to. It is very bad to have an administration where the pipeline incoming is folks who have no integrity and the pipeline outgoing is folks who have to somehow persuade the public that they actually have integrity. And the only way to do that is to show that they weren't part of this like garbage fire that they were just part of. It's very fucked up.
Summertime's here. That means it's time for family vacations, for sunscreen, for barbecues and grilling in the backyard. But really, the most important thing to do this summer is prepare for your family's future with an estate plan from LegalZoom. It's not quite as fun as some other things you could do this summer, but it's honestly more important in the long term. National Make-A-Will Month is right around the corner, and that's the perfect time to make sure you and your family are prepared for the future. And it helps to know what your options are. LegalZoom's not a law firm, but their network of independent attorneys is available in 50 states, and they can work with you to make sure you're getting the right estate plan. Plus, during National Make-A-Will Month, LegalZoom's pulling a bunch of helpful resources together all in one place to make it a little easier to ensure your family and assets are protected. So, you know, if you've been sort of delaying this, you know, you kind of know this is something you ought to do, but you haven't gotten around to it, LegalZoom makes it really easy. This is the perfect time to do it. So keep listening. We'll have more information in August. And to find out more now, check out LegalZoom.com for special offers that are coming your way. If you have a family or own anything you care about, you're not going to want to miss out. In the meantime, save more by entering Weeds at checkout at LegalZoom.com. That's LegalZoom.com.
Hey there, I'm Helen Rosner, one of the hosts of The Eater Upsell, another podcast from the Vox Media Podcast Network. I know I'm interrupting the main show over here, but I think you're going to really like what my co-host Greg Morabito and I are doing, and I want to make sure you know about it. The Eater Upsell is a weekly conversation with some of the smartest, most successful, most interesting people on Earth. About food, usually, but always about culture, creativity, and being a human in the world. On a recent episode, Greg and I talked with David Chang, the man behind the global empire of Momofuku restaurants and one of the primary architects of the way we eat now. In a strikingly candid conversation, Chang opens up about coming to terms with his fame, the rivalries and enemies that fuel him, his quest to be a less angry dude, and his fear of both failure and success. You can find The Eater Upsell at itunes.com/eater or wherever great podcasts can be found.
So we have our white paper. It is an NBER working paper, as is our habit. So this is a paper titled Check Up Before You Check Out, Retail Clinics and Emergency Room Use. It's from Diane Alexander at the Chicago Fed, Molly Schnell and Janet Curry at the Economics Department at Princeton. And what they're exploring is what happens when you have all these retail clinics come into the healthcare environment. Over the past 5 years or so, as I'm sure you've seen wherever it is you live, there's a lot more like clinics at CVS, at Target, at Rite Aid, usually staffed by a nurse practitioner, open often much longer hours, open on the weekends. And as these have really like grown up over the past 5 years or so, there's been kind of this question of what does this do to how people use healthcare? And you could see it going either way. One you see a substitution is that people don't go to the emergency room as much because they, you know, if they have like a sprained ankle, they have strep throat, they can just go to the retail clinic. They know exactly how much it'll cost because the prices are usually posted there. It usually costs a lot less than the emergency room. They get their care, they go home. So you could see a substitution effect, or we have a lot of health research suggesting people will just use more healthcare. Like when it is easier to get your sprained ankle checked out, maybe you wouldn't have gone to the emergency room because you're terrified of a big emergency room bill. But if there's like, you know, $50 to get it checked out at the MinuteClinic, like maybe you will just decide to go to the MinuteClinic just to be safe. And so this is a paper looking at New Jersey in particular, looking at the rise of retail clinics in New Jersey and what happened. And the researchers find, the thing I was most interested in is they find that residents who live close to an open clinic are 12.3% less likely to go to the ER for the flu, 4.1% less likely to use ER for complications of diabetes. They're between 4.7 and 11.4% less likely to go to the ER for a common minor condition. These are things like sprains. And as the authors expect, they do as a control. They look at if people are less likely to go to the ER for things that a MinuteClinic can't treat, like childbirth or a fracture or poisoning. And they find that those visits don't change. Those, obviously, when people have legitimate emergencies, they're still going to the ER at the same rate. And they estimate, if this is, you know, happening all over New Jersey, that this suggests a potential savings of $70 million of less spending on emergency care. So I was interested in this paper because I've had this question about retail clinics. Do they just generate more healthcare spending, or is there actually a substitution effect? And my hope and hunch was the second, and I was excited to see a paper that kind of had that finding that suggested people are doing a bit of substituting, that they're using the retail clinics to replace the emergency experience that was often the only option, like at night or on weekends.
Do we have any health outcomes data on this stuff?
Not in this particular paper.
So I'm conceptually pro minute clinics and all that, but the thing I know that people worry about a little bit is diagnostic. So you go in because you think you just have like a little flu, but in fact you have strep, and then it gets worse. The people who are worried about minute clinics becoming a sort of frontline care provider tend to worry about bigger things getting missed. That's a hard thing to pick up in the data because you need a very big sample size because most things are just the flu or they're just a cold or, you know. But anyway, I'd just be interested to see that data. I mean, in general, I like this because it backs up my intuitions that we should have more things like this. But I would love to see a study with like large-scale health outcomes on all this.
It's interesting to me, you know, looking at this study, that as Republicans have sort of taken over the government and turned their eyes to health policy, that they've shown so little interest in this type of topic. That I thought one of the smarter things that I heard from conservatives, John Cochran has written a lot about this, but so many people, was that the Affordable Care Act didn't really do that much to address like the supply side of the healthcare system, like how can people in need of care, not just financing, but like actually get someone who can take care of them. And we know, you know, there are these questions around regulation of minute clinics. There are questions around scope of practice that nurse practitioners are allowed to provide. There's questions around, you know, how are computers and more advanced artificial intelligence going to be able to enhance medical diagnostics. And it seemed like a promising area for people with strong bias toward free market ideology, but wanting to say they were going to do something constructive to help people get health treatment would be to look at these kind of things. Maybe we should change rules so that more states can expand their minute clinic offerings. But this has been completely absent from their Affordable Care Act, repeal stop, even though every bit of research that I've seen along these lines suggests that we really do excessively restrict who is able to provide healthcare services and in what kind of manner are they able to provide them. And in particular, things like minute clinics, you know, they help address the sort of exactly the people who are not necessarily that helped by ACA, like middle class-ish people who are not necessarily in need of like huge or not in line for big kind of federal subsidies, but who benefit from convenience and competition and lower costs.
I mean, not to recapitulate our earlier conversation, but this seems to me to be part of the problem of not going through a real process and going through reconciliation and all the rest of it. They didn't take time and have the flexibility to come up with theories of cost control. And so I don't know. One thing you would hope about legislating in America, even in a pretty partisan time, is that the left and the right both do have insights about how these things work and tend to be focused a little bit on different problems, particularly their policy wings of the different ideological movements. And so as you kind of ping pong back and forth and control, you would get policy reflecting those insights. And Republicans have, in this case, decided to work in such a constrained, quick, and procedurally cramped process. They're not bringing any of their more valuable insights to bear. It's just like total Calvin ball. What can we do within the context of like the insurance regulations and subsidies within the Affordable Care Act? Whereas, like, as you say, like you really could have imagined a Republican effort here that both restructured the Affordable Care Act and the health system, but also had a lot of stuff about occupational licensing and supply side constraints and, you know, how do you design insurance? And there are interesting ideas there that in much a way that the Obama administration had this huge part of the Affordable Care Act that was all about trying to move the system through Medicare through a pay for performance as opposed to a pay for volume pricing model. You know, Republicans have other versions of those more systemic critiques about delivery. And, you know, those were not necessarily embodied in the Affordable Care Act. And it would have been probably valuable to have some of them thought through, worked through, and more embodied in this bill. But I recognize that's just taking this paper and bringing it back to our
But it actually, I think it actually ties into your question earlier about like, what about the health outcomes? Like, is there a risk of being seen and kind of by a less experienced practitioner? And I think the way these retail clinics actually work best and like something you might think through in regulating them is when they're integrated into a larger health system. So one of the big concerns I hear from doctors is that retail clinics are going to fragment care, that their patients are, you know, just going to start going to the retail clinic. A doctor won't have like a complete sense of what's actually going on in that person's life, like these things that they're being seen at this like kind of clinic they don't know about. But I know of a few experiments where these retail clinics are integrated into larger health systems. So they're working with a local hospital system. They have like a shared electronic medical record. And then you get the sense you really could deal with the health outcomes issue if you have some kind of, you know, data sharing where someone's reviewing the stuff that's been going on in the retail clinic. Or one of the things they mentioned in this paper about New Jersey that might mitigate some of the negative health outcomes is their licensing works where the nurse practitioners, they have to be supervised by the doctor, but the doctor doesn't necessarily need to be there. They have kind of like a protocol list where if some X, Y, or Z thing happens, they are required to call the supervising doctor and get kind of a consult with them. And, you know, increased integration with other parts of the healthcare system, I think, could mitigate some of the fragmentation, some of the concerns about health outcomes, and could be something, you know, a state legislature looks at when they think about how do we want these retail clinics to work? Like, how can they best serve the people who live in our state?
That seems right. State legislators, if you're listening.
Yes. Yes. And if you want to serve your friends best, you could recommend that they listen to The Weeds. Tell them, leave us a review on iTunes. You could join our Facebook group and become part of a awesome growing community that talks about all sorts of nerdy policy things. There are a lot of great threads happening about health policy lately that I have been really, really enjoying. You could also do yourself a service by listening to some other Vox Media podcasts, such as the Ezra Klein Show.
Or Worldly, our new foreign policy podcast, which has been really excellent lately. Or I Think You're Interesting with Todd Vanderwoof, which if you want to stop thinking about politics and policy all the time, which I think is probably a good thing to do, his cultural interviews are really fantastic.
Thanks to our producers, Peter Leonard and Jillian Weinberger for producing. Thanks to our friends here at Maine Public Radio in Bangor who helped us out. We are going to be back on Friday where we will be talking about whatever it is that emerges from this mysterious Senate healthcare process. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you in a couple days.